Part 3 of 9 from set number 3014, The Great Magicians, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Magicians of the Golden Dawn and Their Magic.
By way of introducing this evening's topic, let's try to create just a little short background for the subject of magic and magicians. The term magic, or magia in Latin and in Greek, magie in German, la magie in French, I don't really have to go through all the languages, I don't suppose, is derived from an ancient Indo-Aryan root word M-A-G, mag, which relates to greatness. And even in English we have such words as magnitude, magnification, all of these have to do with greatness. Curiously enough, even the word or the name magnet has a relationship to it, because it comes from the island of Magnes, where it was said that a lot of lodestones were to be found, and a magnet, as you can see when you put it down and you have little iron shavings, becomes bigger, and so we have the magnitude there. So, all right then, what does this have to do with our subject? One way, which is certainly not the only way in which this can be explained, is that the greatness that we seek by the enlargement of our souls, by the enlargement of our consciousness, may be approached, I don't want to use the word accessed, because that word is somewhat of a neologism and therefore an abomination. So we won't say accessed. So now therefore I said it already twice, see? But anyway, we can gain access to that greatness in the main in two different ways. And one of these is by the direct inward way, which is the way of introspective meditation and related disciplines. So that we might say that there is inside of us, there is an opening to the ineffable greatness, and if we can go to it, then through that, with our consciousness, proceed there. The other might be called the indirect or reflective or projective way, whereby the elements of that ineffable greatness are projected outward and perceived either through the mind's eye, in consciousness, or in other ways as if they were outside of ourselves, and then by way of various procedures, usually of a ceremonial or ritual nature, we can perceive them. The word projection in this regard, which has been used by many people, including depth psychologists, is an apt one, because if you look at what is happening even today, I believe, technology changes so fast, by way of, let's see, what is happening in a motion picture theater, then you can recognize that the film with its little bitty pictures on it is back there in the projector, and when it is projected, then it is magnified many, many times on the screen, and there you are able to see it, and therefore are able to perceive it. Now, all of these similes and metaphors are, of course, inadequate to approach such subjects, but I think it would be fair to say that this second or projective method, to a major extent, is the way of magic. And that it is very effective, because the various powers and potencies of the soul, and let's say of the soul's realm, the soul's world, to put it in those flowery terms, can be much more clearly perceived when it is thus projected onto the screen of perception, and there we are able then to commune with it and realize it in various ways. This is obviously not the only metaphor whereby magic can be explained, but it is one, and it is probably a fairly helpful one. We also need to remember that in many disciplines, as for instance in the one that comes to mind, although there are many others, the Vajrayana Buddhism of Tibet, the religious practices consist of both of these methods. There is a lot of introspective interior meditation, but there is also a great deal of ceremonial, magical, ritual procedure, and these together then add up to the kind of enlargement of consciousness that is desired. Now, the ceremonial magical tradition, which has been practiced in the West, whereby we really mean originally the Mediterranean area, is probably derived with the greatest degree of likelihood from some of the ancient Mediterranean cultures, particularly from the Greeks, whose Neoplatonic schools, Neoplatonic traditions in late antiquity when Christianity has started already, acted as probably the principal models, although there were others, of ceremonial magic. Now, you need to remember that, of course, the Neoplatonists, this means such teachers as Ammonius and Plotinus and particularly Proclus and Iamblichus, that this tradition with its teachers was still following the theogonic and theological model of ancient Greece with its gods and goddesses. And so the Neoplatonists would practice rites of invocation, wherein they would call in the consciousness of various gods and various goddesses and would hold discourse with them. And, you know, you can see at least sort of the theoretical example of that in some books such as, in the Orphic Hymns translated by Thomas Taylor, a very wonderful book, where the invocations to the gods and the goddesses are mentioned. And then each time it says at the heading, to the fumigation of such and such. And these are the particular incenses which would be burned for a particular deity. As time went on, and as the ancient model of the non-Christian or pagan forms of ceremonial magic had to modify itself, these invocatory rites became what often is called angel magic. The invocations of celestial and cosmic and transcosmic beings who in the monotheistic traditions are usually referred to as angels. In addition to that, there was also the lesser magic, which is still part of the ceremonial magical tradition, which is the goetia or natural magic, which had to do with the evocation of submundane and mundane non-physical or spiritual forces and beings. And that is how the ceremonial magical tradition continued in the West. And there were various times when it sort of underwent a period of flourishing, of considerable expansion. Such a time was the time of the Renaissance, when along with alchemy, the ceremonial magical practices became quite popular and used a great deal, and in various ways in other periods of history. That brings us up with great leaps over time, now to the 19th century, when in the latter part of the 19th century, latter quarter of the 19th century, there occurred a great revival of what might be called the alternative mystical or alternative spiritual tradition, whereby we mean the one that was not directly linked to or with Christianity. And this occurred, again, in two ways. One was primarily theoretical, where the intellectual aspect of the teachings of the esoteric tradition was taught, now for the first time in many hundreds of years, openly and available to all of those who wish to listen or to read. The principal figure in bringing forth and in the revival of that intellectual part of the tradition was Madame Blavatsky. And the umbrella term for her system of teaching was called Theosophy, and still is, which in turn, interestingly enough, is taken from the Neoplatonists again, because it was Ammonius Saccas, the founder of the Neoplatonic school, who first used that term, divine wisdom, or the wisdom of the gods. So, beginning in 1875, when the Theosophical Society was founded in New York City, this revival, let's say, of the esoteric tradition was present and attracted considerable attention both in America and in Europe and ultimately in India as well. But it was, as I say, it was theoretical, it was didactic. It consisted of teaching in lectures, which were, of course, a very big modality of learning and of communication at that time, and in the writing and publishing of books. So when it came, not so very long after that, came to the 1880s, then an increasing number of persons, in this particular case originally in England, but eventually in other places as well, came to the conclusion that all that theory was nice and good and well, but that some practice would also be nice or helpful. Or as Goethe writes in his great drama, The Faust, at a certain point when Mephistopheles is speaking to Faust and he says, Grau, mein Freund, ist alle Theorie. Remember, gray, my friend, is all theory, but precious is the golden tree of life. So in a sense, you might say that golden tree of life consists at least in part of magic. And we even use such terms sometimes when we are out in some very nice surroundings and natural surroundings out in the wilderness or in the park, or somebody say how magical all of this is. It is, because it possesses its own power whereby it impresses our consciousness. And so it was as the result of this desire and effort directed toward the practical exercise and application of spiritual forces. Let's say, the spiritual, the occult in action, rather than purely in theory, that the second seminal great organization of the late 19th century, in addition to the Theosophical Society and its many branches, came into existence, which came to be called the Order of the Golden Dawn. Now, we will hear about some of the, throughout these talks, about some of the outstanding personalities who were associated with the leadership and the activities of the Golden Dawn, in part because I feel that getting a glimpse of what these people were like, we personally come closer to the issues at hand and the practices at hand. The best way to affinitize yourself to a particular practice is to meet a practitioner. And so we shall do that also, but I would like to also share with you a little more theoretical information about all of this. The history of that seminal movement, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, proves that it was truly that, a seed movement, which managed to bring many results and consequences in the future. The Order of the Golden Dawn didn't last very long. Its main body was in activity only a little bit over 20 years. So you might say outwardly it came to grief, but spiritually or in spirit it continued. A conclusion to be drawn probably is that we should not judge an organization by its worldly success or permanence. A group of great people can accomplish more in 15 or 20 years than a herd of dolts and weaklings in 100 years or 1,000 years. And the second, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, is the second conclusion which we may draw from the brief but intense outward history of the Golden Dawn is that it's hazardous to mix subjective psychic experiences with a tradition. The magical tradition has, let's say, its formal structures, the magical practices have their traditional forms. But owing to the fact that the period of time, right before the turn of the century from the 19th to the 20th, when the, we'll just refer to it generically as the Golden Dawn, don't have to say all the time, the Order of the Golden Dawn, when the Golden Dawn functioned, there was also a great deal of subjective, often uncontrolled and uncontrollable psychism. The historical reasons for this really don't matter, but beginning in the late 1840s, there came the, which was a tremendous big popular movement of spiritualism. Connected with that and growing out of it, a lot of attention being given to communication with unseen entities, visionary reality, clairvoyance, clairaudience, things of that sort, often involved with attempts to so-called scientific attempts to investigate these activities, which of course never really works. And the reason for it being that the methods and principles of the physical sciences cannot be applied very well to the inward, to the psyche, or to the spirit. So, you know, all of these things were around and were about, and obviously they also intruded, let's say, into the milieu of the Golden Dawn and similar activities, and they caused a certain amount of harm and a certain amount of confusion. The, let's say, undisciplined psychics and mediums are deadly to a valid tradition. Modern depth psychological study, on the other hand, helps and has been applied to these matters. And that is, let's say, also a conclusion to be drawn from the fate of the Golden Dawn. But in spite of these difficulties and internal dissensions and eventually schisms and so forth, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was a tremendous creative matrix wherein the magical tradition and its practice came forward and was put into the kind of shape and framework that it could be passed on in various ways to future generations, as indeed it has. Now, the Golden Dawn functioned in an initiatory manner. This is part of the magical-mystical tradition, because the expansion of consciousness as envisioned really by much of the ancient esoteric tradition is an initiatory one, which means that there are certain steps that one takes to more and more interior consciousness, and that when these steps are formalized, then we have an initiatory body of people. Remnants of that are around in various ways, particularly in the great and I think still splendid Masonic order, the orders of Freemasonry, and indeed we will see in a minute that there was really a very close connection between the, particularly the beginning of the Golden Dawn and Freemasonry. And in others because that initiatory expansion of consciousness really appertains to the tradition, and the tradition that comes down from the mysteries of old. This is the way in which the mysteries, such as the Eleusinian mysteries, the Orphic mysteries, the mysteries of Dionysus, the mysteries of Isis in the ancient world, were practiced. Now, the initiatory system of the Golden Dawn was patterned on the Tree of Life of the Kabbalah. The order actually consisted of two great divisions, the outer order and the inner order. The outer order was strictly Kabbalistic and conformed in its symbolism very largely to the Kabbalistic terminology. These were the grades, or I suppose if you use the Masonic term you might call them degrees, but in the Golden Dawn they were called grades of the order. Neophyte, which is the level at which the person entered the order, which in terms of the structure of the Tree of Life, which some of you may be familiar with, others may be not, is actually sort of below the tree. It's below the sphere of Malkuth, before you enter the tree. The next degree or grade was Zelator, which is in the sphere of Malkuth, the tenth Sephira, the lowest vessel on the Tree of Life. The third grade, Theoricus, was in the sphere of Yesod, which is one step further up on the Tree of Life. The fourth step, Philosophus, was in the sphere of Netzach, another step up on the Tree of Life. The fifth step, Practicus, was attributed to the sphere of Hord, after which came an intermediate step called the portal grade or Zelator Adeptus Minor. And then in the grade of Tifareth, which is at the very center of the Tree of Life, when the Tree of Life is properly drawn, which is sort of like the central sun, and which really divides the lower and the upper portion of the Tree of Life, there in the sphere of Tifaret we had Adeptus Minor, or the Minor Adept. Now the grades above that, which were still conformed to a Tree of Life, were part of what often was called the Inner Order, and which had as its name the Ordo Rosae Rubae et Aureae Crucis, and don't worry, I'll translate it for you. Unlike one of my university professors in Austria who would go on talking in Greek for about 15-20 minutes and then stop and ask us, does anybody know ancient Greek here? And then maybe two or three people put up their hands and say, oh, well, I better translate it. So I better do that too. And it means the order of the red rose and the golden cross. The practical work in the progression of consciousness in this manner on the Tree of Life included mastering the qualities of the four elements of earth, air, fire, and water, the unifying of the spiritual quintessence within the person, and the entry into the higher worlds. I can say from both a theoretical but also a practical point of view that this was and is an excellent system. The manner in which the rituals, especially the grade, the initiatory rituals, the grade rituals of the Golden Dawn were devised is a work of real genius. And I'll tell you in a few minutes as to how that came about. It is really, in my view, and using contemporary terms of largely of depth psychological provenance, we might call it a supremely meaningful system of symbolic individuation. The Tree of Life, of course, has been recognized by students of the Kabbalah for a very long time as the great integrator and organizer of spiritual growth. One of the people who had his training with the Golden Dawn, and about whom we will talk in much greater detail in a later lecture, has likened the Tree of Life to a gigantic psycho-spiritual filing system. Now, of course, those was in the days when there were no computer files, and they had the kind of files that I have, which are in a cabinet, you see, and then I can reach in and pull them out and put them back and get them mixed up and all that sort of thing. And which really means that if you have a working knowledge of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, then you have places symbolically expressed where you can put virtually every experience of your life. And you can see how that would make life really a lot more meaningful than without it. Because when you can take your experience and associate it with a particular spiritual condition, with a particular level of spiritual attainment, then you have a way of understanding your life and the meaning of its various parts and portions that is really very, very useful. So what we need to keep in mind then, that the initiatory structure of the Golden Dawn was consciously and purposefully organized in such a way that it might denote and document and stimulate spiritual growth and progress. Now you might say, does that mean that every person who, let's say, reached the level of practicus or adeptus minor in the Golden Dawn was therefore a spiritually highly developed person? Well, probably not. But it represented a model. And with each step there were certain studies, there were certain meditations, there were certain practices, so that, let's say, at least the likelihood of some actual spiritual growth taking place by way of this initiatory progress was there and was considerable. This is very important, because we need to keep in mind that in spite of the, let's say, really very great wealth of theory and practice that was present in the Golden Dawn. In fact, I would say maybe a little bit too much. Because those valiant old folk, they look old to us from now, but you know, actually many of them were quite young when they got into that. They were in their 30s, they were in their 40s, and very vigorous people, you know, they really bit off almost more than one can comfortably chew, to use that culinary metaphor. They wanted to have an initiatory system of spiritual progression, one. They wanted a theoretical academy of the occult arts and sciences where people would learn everything there is to learn in the esoteric field. And they wanted to practice magic according to the principles of ceremonial magic and to integrate all of this into a system whereby the person would learn theoretically and practically, inwardly and outwardly, how to relate himself, herself to the inner worlds. By the way, from its very inception, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn accepted women on an exactly equal basis with men, which was very, very unusual at that time, is still unusual in some circles, you know. Freemasonry, which I have tremendous respect for, still has difficulty with that particular issue. And in spite of the fact that the leading members of the Golden Dawn, the founders, were all Freemasons, they wanted a place now where the women could be there and become temple officials and become initiates and participate in that process of spiritual transformation. Now, a few of the practices of the Golden Dawn. What we are dealing with now here are the preliminary training of the Golden Dawn adept. In addition to the temple rituals of opening and closing and of the various initiatory rituals, these were the practices which quite early in the process people were encouraged to engage in, and training was given to them as to how to conduct these practices. And as you will see, practically all of these have remained and have been with us since then as fairly popular practices within the esoteric or occult tradition. The first of these is divination. There was very little known about and very little practiced of divination in the late 19th century, because divination had been let go by the educated and, quote, the civilized people, and it became fortune-telling primarily in the hands of gypsies. Now, being a Hungarian by birth, I have considerable respect for the gypsies, both as musicians, which, of course, is all the music for dancing and other purposes that we always listen to in Hungary. The country people in Hungary would have considered it below their status to pick up a fiddle, you know, or anything else. The gypsy was the one who played the music. No. That doesn't mean we didn't have philharmonic orchestras in the cities, but the country music was always gypsy music, you know. Now, the gypsies, of course, also were great practitioners of fortune-telling, which is a kind of devolved and highly personalized form of divination. But we need to remember that divination of various sorts is an extremely important ancient practice pretty much everywhere, but very highly developed in the Mediterranean area, very highly developed. The Romans and the Greeks, the Egyptians, all felt that by certain practices one could consult the whom? The divinities. That's where you get the term divination from. Because the divinities, which is the gods and the goddesses and demigods and demigoddesses, not were there any quarter gods, no, I think, you know, that they are all there and they are essentially benign. They are interested in helping us. But we have to consult them. We have to talk to them. We have to make ways, instrumentalities, modalities available to them in order that they might give us insight into our lives and guidance and so forth. That's the idea behind divination. So it's really a very supernatural, magical, and to a certain extent even mystical practice. And so it was this kind of practice that the Golden Dawn felt people, the members, the initiates should engage in, not just for the practical benefit, which no doubt was there also, but they felt that by way of practicing divination, as my late acquaintance, Dr. Francis Israel Regardi of blessed memory, was wont to say, it sharpens your magical intuition. It stimulates certain faculties within you that otherwise might remain inactive and dormant. So the Golden Dawn brought in all kinds of divinatory modalities that they could avail themselves of. They were the great revivers of the tarot. Without the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, I would venture to guess there would be very little tarot around. Because the tarot they valued very highly as a divinatory modality, but also as a symbol system which can be combined with the symbolism of the Tree of Life of the Kabbalah, because as some of you may recall, the Tree of Life, the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, consists of the 10 Sephirot, but also of 22 channels or paths which connect these mystical vessels. And to these 22 connecting channels, the Golden Dawn, in its own way, with its own system, attributed the 22 cards of the major arcana. They also found a place for the minor arcana on the Tree of Life, but I don't need to go into that. So the tarot was very important for them. Now there weren't a heck of a lot of tarot cards around, even, you know, bookstores in London or in Paris or anywhere. You'd be lucky if you found even a single deck. It was usually the Marseille deck, old French deck that was about. So the Golden Dawn devised its own tarot symbolism, and this as to what imagery, what is supposed to be on each card. And they gave these instruction sheets to the members. And then, believe it or not, the members had to make their own cards. If we insisted on that nowadays in our tarot classes, everybody would run away. Because people don't want to do that kind of work. But, you know, and highly symbolic according to their own symbology images of the cards. There has been, over the last few decades, there has been at least one tarot deck published that was of that nature, and it was made originally on the basis of the private self-produced deck of Dr. Regardi, who then gave the instructions to an acquaintance of his, an artist by the name of Wong, and then Mr. Wong made the so-called Golden Dawn deck that you can get. But don't think that that was the only kind of, I mean, the same kind of symbolic elements, yeah, would be present on the cards, but everybody having made his own, the cards were still turned out very, very differently. But the color scheme and everything else, they were told what to do. I have seen only one handmade deck, Golden Dawn deck, in my life, and that was one time I was lecturing about the tarot in, I believe, Portland, Oregon. And a gentleman came up to me and said, I have something here I'd like you to see. Tell me what this is. Well, it was a tarot deck, all right. It didn't have the colors, which I suppose was permissible. It was drawn with black ink on white, very nicely executed, and on the back of each card there was written very nicely lettered all the attributions. Astrological attributions, Hebrew letters, you know, various other attributions. So, look, that is, you know, this is a handmade Golden Dawn deck. The man had absolutely no idea what it was or what it might be worth, and my unfortunate, sometimes unfortunate honesty impelled me to tell him, you know, this could be worth a great deal of money. This could be worth much more money than I can offer you. Since I had maybe $5 in my pocket, you know, and so I sent him on his way. But I must say, I had some regrets of having let that particular fish slip away from my hands back into the water. But it was very, very beautiful. So that was primarily the kind of tarot that they used, but they used the tarot for meditations in connection with the Tree of Life, and I certainly can't go into that, but if you're interested in that sort of thing, back in 1975 I had authored a little book that originally was called The Royal Road and now is called The Fool's Pilgrimage, in which I outlined the system of meditation which is taken from the Golden Dawn, but somewhat abbreviated for present use, and of course for divination. Believe it or not, they also brought to the West and started utilizing the ancient Chinese oracle of the I Ching. Now you can well believe that there were not many people in the Western countries who were interested in this old Chinese stuff. After all, that was long, long before the time when every kind of sort of dime store item, although there are no more dime stores, that we pick up somewhere is made in China. You know, that wasn't the time. Nothing came to the West at that time made in China. Probably not even the I Ching. But in any event, they got hold of it and they used it for divinatory purposes. They taught also and greatly respected astrology. They had another system which is not very much used. It's actually a very sort of simple system of divination once you learn it. It's called geomancy. Now that really means divining by earth, and it was originally way, way back, probably in Alexandrian Egypt, or sort of practiced with sand, where certain make certain dots in the sand and you read those dots. Let's just say these were the main ones: Tarot, I Ching, astrology, and geomancy. But the Golden Dawn was interested really in any divinatory device because it felt that the magical imagination of the person was stimulated thereby, a tool of the magical intuition. So what they were really doing here, so they felt, they created a sensitivity to what today, under the influence of the late and great Dr. Carl Jung, we might call synchronicity. And I can't go into that in any great detail also, but it's still, I think, a very mysterious but extremely valuable and wonderful subject. It is the meaningful coming together of outwardly, causally unrelated circumstances, which by coming together can reveal powerful meaning to the individual. So there it is, divination. The second discipline that was practiced by the Golden Dawn was vision as it was called. This really had to do, well, there is more to it than that, but it had to do in a sense with the communing with the spiritual presences of the four elements. Now, the four elements in the Western system are earth, water, fire, and air. But they also, let's say, added to these the symbols of what in the Hindu systems, particularly in the Hindu tantras, are called the tattvas. And the way that these exercises of vision work, that there are certain basic symbols. And they are not just the symbols of the elements, but really of a kind of the spiritual core of the elements, but that doesn't make that much difference. Say, the tattva symbol, as used by the Golden Dawn, of the element of earth is a yellow square. So once again, the people made for themselves tattva cards. And they had these cards in front of them, looked at them, and meditated on the cards, which in this case means looking intently at the card while you control your breathing. Now, what happens is, and I can testify to that, if you have that symbol in front of you and you're really quiet and you're not distracted by anything, after a while it begins to change. It takes on another color. Becomes sort of violet, usually. And then there's sort of movement, it becomes like a door, a gate into a visionary reality. And much of the time with your consciousness you sort of go through that. And then, then anything can happen. But the likelihood is that you then sort of envision and deal with and probably have some either telepathic or verbal interaction with entities pertaining to that particular element. With the earth it would be something like gnomes. And similarly you have then the tattvas of water, the tattvas of air, tattva of fire, which is the red triangle, and the akasha triangle, which is a kind of a bluish egg, and each one of these sort of brings in a different spiritual influence. So once again, doing these kinds of meditations sharpens the visionary capacities of the individual, enlarges their consciousness, right? That is the exercise of vision. And then there are two more which really pertain to ceremonial magic proper. They are evocation and invocation. Now, these are major operations to which usually several people are required, although a highly trained adept might perform them alone as well, but it's much more difficult that way. Evocation is within the Goetic or Solomonic magic, according to usually the lesser or greater key of Solomon, and it's full-blown ceremonial magic. There is the circle of protection, which is drawn on the ground. There is, at the apex of the circle of protection, there is the triangle of manifestation. The magus stands in the circle of protection. That's why it's a protection, to protect him. With his magical wand, he has the sword, he has the cup, he has the pentacle there. The incense fumes are rising to the sky, and different incenses according to what kind of entity is to be evoked. And then, when there are several people present, there is also what is called the receiver, who stands there by the triangle of manifestation and who often looks into a mirror. And then in the mirror, or maybe just in the air, the evoked entity appears. It's long process of conjuration, many long formulae whereby certain entities are told to appear. They are preceded and followed by elaborate and lengthy prayers to God to make this operation helpful and to have a successful operation. The very frequent use of evocation was not advised and is considered to be a little bit dangerous. They're not in dangerous in the sense that big monster is going to jump out and bite off your head. I've really never heard of such thing happening. but let's say, owing to the very impressive nature of the activity, it can create some anxious or excessive conditions in the mind. And in all of these, by the way, again, as Dr. Israel Regardi was wont to point out, neurotics don't make good magicians. But he also added to it, being a trained psychologist, but unfortunately it's precisely the neurotics who are attracted to magic more than anyone else. So you really have a serious problem there. Serious problem. Being a psychotherapist, of course, he advised the good course of therapy prior to people engaging in these matters. And then the fourth of the practices is invocation, which deals with, as I mentioned before, angel magic, the celestial beings, much more benign, but in many ways also much more difficult operation. And in all of these, the issue is, of course, that even though in the Golden Dawn system you do these in order to strengthen your own spiritual and visionary faculties, that you also have to have a serious reason in addition to that to do this, because otherwise these entities in an evocation or invocation, they will look at you and tell you, why did you call me? What have you got to say for yourself? What question do you have? And if you don't have a good one, they show displeasure. They say, oh, well, you know, you call me here, you disturb my condition, my rest, and then you don't have any valid questions, you know, what kind of a thing is this? It's not all that nice to evoke the ire of these beings, you know. As I say, I haven't seen any of them come bite anybody's head off, but it's not. So these are the preliminary operations whereby the first order, the members of the Golden Dawn would be strengthening their own visionary and magical qualities. Now a little bit about some people which I promised. And I think, once again, don't look upon this just as historical detail, but, and I'll do my best to help you with that, but, you know, try to feel what these people were like. Because by getting a feeling of their character, of their talents, of their nature, we get an idea what a real magician is like. Now, the whole business of the Golden Dawn, I mean, the entire process of the idea that there should be an Order of the Golden Dawn and its founding and so forth, started in 1880, when an Anglican clergyman, the Reverend Woodford, A.F.A. Woodford, bought a bundle of cipher manuscripts from a used bookstore in Farringdon Street in London. Now, you need a little bit of a kind of, to use the name of another Golden Dawn member, kind of a Dion Fortune imagination, because Dion Fortune wrote these highly romantic, magical novels, you know. So it's kind of, you can sort of imagine the London fog in the 19th century, London street, and there is this Anglican clergyman with his high dark collar, you know, and his long frock coat, and maybe his gaiters, you know, what gaiters are, they are sort of something that you put on your legs. It's good against mud and everything else, but clergymen wore them, you know, and his big hat, and he's wandering down the street, coming to the old bookstore there, and somehow out of one of the books or so, this bundle of papers falls out. And they are in cipher. And of course, the problem with cipher is, if you want to understand it, you have to decipher it. But accompanying these pieces of paper with their ciphers on them was a letter. And this letter was capable of being read by the good gentleman. It was in German, however. And the German letter said that whoever wished to decipher the text should communicate with a person with the pseudonym Sapiens Dominabitur Astris, which in Latin means the wise shall rule above the stars, or rule the stars. I usually use that sentence to annoy astrologers. And I tell them, you know, the stars are not here to rule you, the wise shall rule over the stars, shall dominate the stars. Anyway, and this person, a mysterious person, could be reached via an address, and a Fräulein Anna Sprengel, a German lady in Nuremberg in Germany. Now, the Reverend Mr. Woodford then contacted several of his Masonic brothers, who were all members of a Masonic organization called Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia, the Rosicrucian Society in England. Masonic Rosicrucianism still exists, by the way, and it's not a secret. There is an American one, too. Its headquarters is in Washington, D.C. And what it is really, it is sort of a Masonic study club, mainly. In order to join that, you have to be a Freemason. And it is the Masonic body that is particularly devoted to the study of esoterica. I have given lectures to one of the local chapters. Very, very fine and very studious people. So here were a number of these gentlemen, the principal Freemasons who were thus introduced to the mysterious cipher manuscript were a Dr. Woodman, and the Dr. William Wynne Westcott, both of these medical men, and the redoubtable Samuel Liddell MacGregor Mathers, as he subsequently came to call himself. Dr. William Wynne Westcott was a very fine and very interesting man. He was a medical man. You know, in England you don't have to have the title doctor to be a medical practitioner. Doctor is a teaching title, a teaching degree. Most of the medical practitioners in England are bachelors of medicine, and then members of the Royal Society of Surgeons or the Royal Society of Medicine. You know? So that's what he was. By way of his practice, he was one of the several coroners of the city of London, which is kind of a little irony. Here is a man who becomes tremendously interested in magic, as we'll soon see, and then he deals with dead bodies all the time. Now, a voodoo practitioner would consider that very appropriate, maybe not everybody else. In any event, he was a high-grade Freemason, an enthusiastic theosophist, and a close friend and personal disciple of Madame Blavatsky, who was, of course, right around that time in London. And he was one of the very few people whom she has asked to do that ever in her life. He was a collaborator with Madame Blavatsky on the book Theosophical Glossary, which is almost like a dictionary, you know, various esoteric terms defined, where he wrote all the entries dealing with Kabbalah and Rosicrucianism. In the 1892 edition of that book, Theosophical Glossary, the editor G.R.S. Mead, the great translator and another close disciple of Madame Blavatsky, in the preface described him thus. The articles marked www were contributed at the special request of H.P.B., that's H.P. Blavatsky, by Brother W.W. Westcott, Bachelor of Medicine, past Master and past Zelator, who is Secretary General of the Rosicrucian Society, whereby he meant the Masonic Rosicrucian Society, and Premonstrator of the Kabbalah to the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. In the same work, and I think we can probably still do that, there is a very telling short little paragraph written by Westcott in which he defines, as these are all, you know, definitions, defines Rosicrucians. Here it is, Rosicrucians. The name was first given to the disciples of a learned adept named Christian Rosenkreuz, who flourished in Germany circa 1460. He founded an order of mystical students whose early history is to be found in the German work Frama Fraternitatis, 1614, which has been published in several languages. The members of the order maintained their secrecy, but traces of them have been found in various places every half a century since these dates. The Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia, which I mentioned before, is a Masonic order which has adopted membership in the outer, the Kabrat, Zerech, Aur, Bocher, and other organizations, and the Order of the Golden Dawn. So he mentions it here, which has a very complete scheme of initiation into the Kabbalah and the higher magic of the Western or Hermetic type, and admits both sexes, is a direct descendant from medieval sodalities of Rosicrucians, themselves descended from the ancient mysteries. This is how Dr. Westcott himself defined Rosicrucians. So there is a definite connection with, apparently, with German Rosicrucianism, after all, that's where Rosicrucianism started, of that particular type. Dr. Westcott was a man of medium height, having a close beard, very active and very agile, and described by everyone who knew him as a man of singular truthfulness, integrity, and learning. So the notion that he or really any of these people would have somehow forged this cipher manuscript or so is a bunch of, I think, is very, very unlikely. He was also a very fine linguist, translated from both the Hebrew and the Greek and also Latin. He continued to correspond with Miss Anna Sprengel in Germany, and in 1888 received not only authorization from her to form with his associates an elementary branch of the Rosicrucian order in England, but Westcott was also authorized by her to sign, to put the signature of Sapiens Dominabito Astris on a warrant or charter which was drawn up for the founding document of the Golden Dawn, signed on 1st of March 1888. By that time, meetings were already held occasionally, new members initiated. According to some of the sources, the great poet William Butler Yeats was initiated in May 1887. For some 10 years, Dr. Westcott acted as one of the three chiefs of the order, as they were called, just chiefs, kind of like Indian chief, you know. But in 1897, he had to withdraw because of his profession. The office of the Lord Mayor of London was displeased that one of their coroners was a practicing magician. They just didn't like that at all. So he had to officially resign. The second chief, Dr. Woodman, having died earlier, after about 1897, Samuel Liddell Mathers reigned supreme as the chief until sometime after 1900. Now a few words about this man who, you know, I almost think that Samuel Liddell McGregor Mathers would have done well in Los Angeles. He was a sorrowfully flamboyantly romantic figure, as Westcott was a sort of subdued, you know, low-key medical doctor. Mathers, who wore kilts most of the time with a dagger, you know, in his socks, and a long flowing cape, and a huge, gigantic Scottish stick, which I think also doubled as his magic wand, was what one might say, without too much insult, a real character. he first was known as Samuel Liddell Mathers. Later on, he called himself MacGregor as well, and he claimed the Jacobite French title of Count of Glenstrae. He was certainly a man of high drama and romance. William Butler Yeats, the poet, described him in 1887 when he met him, described Mathers as a man of 36 or 37 in a brown velveteen coat with a gaunt, resolute face, and who seemed, before I even heard his name or knew the nature of his studies, a figure of romance. They met, like so many other people of various kinds, in the reading room of the British Museum. If you ever go there, you know, think of that. Don't think of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, for heaven's sakes, you know, miserable guys. But think of Samuel Liddell MacGregor Mathers, Count of Glenstrae. Mathers was married to a lady who was, if anything, more talented even and more of a romantic figure than himself. Moina Bergson, who was the sister of the noted French philosopher Henri Bergson. You know, even when I went to school, since there was a lot being taught about Henri Bergson, he was the founder of a philosophical school that you don't hear very much nowadays anymore, that is often referred to as vitalism. And it was sort of a counter philosophy to materialism. You know, the reality is not matter, but it's life, the energies of life, the élan vital, as Bergson called it. One wonders whether perhaps Professor Bergson may have been influenced a little bit by the magical ideas of his sister and his brother-in-law, too. It's not at all impossible. Mrs. Mathers, Moina, was also, well, let's say, a person of considerable occult power and visions. And when the rituals initially of the Golden Dawn were put together, the cipher manuscripts, by the way, when deciphered, contained 5 initiatory rituals of the first 5 degrees. That's what was there. But the lady in Germany also asked Westcott and Mathers and the rest of them to add to them, to flesh them out, and to add instructions to them, and so forth. And much of this was done with the magnificent poetic genius of Yeats, but also by way of the visions of Moina Matthews, who in addition to all of her other talents was also an excellent painter, an excellent artist. And you know, a lot of ritual paraphernalia for a Golden Dawn temple require painted materials. There are pictures of gods, Egyptian gods, all kinds of things. And she also, I think, was the first one to paint all the various parts of the vault of Christian Rosenkreuz, in which the highest degree of the Golden Dawn is conferred. It's like a cube, and on each side there are all kinds of painted designs and so forth, very impressive sort of thing, and so she did that too. Very, very interesting and outstanding lady. I think a niece, a relative of Matthews, by the name of Itel Colquhoun, in her book The Sword of Wisdom, which is primarily about Matthews and about Moina Matthews, you know, writes about her aunt with a great deal of respect. From a certain time on, Matthews and his wife moved from England to Paris, where they had a little Golden Dawn temple, but he was still the supreme chief of the Golden Dawn, and he went back at various times to the London temple. There were a whole bunch of other temples too, to conduct some of the great seasonal rituals, including the Corpus Christi ritual, when the supreme magus, the chief, is tied to a cross. And that he always had that done. He always went to England for that. So Matthews then died in 1917 during World War I in London. In the meantime, several prominent members broke away from the Golden Dawn, among them Arthur Edward Waite, who is still known to us now because of the Waite tarot deck, Dr. Felkin, who eventually founded a temple in New Zealand, some of the remnants of which or whom I still discovered over there, because there were people around there who very secretively came up to me, and when I was in New Zealand, they confided to me that they were Golden Dawn people. The Felkin's order still continued there. And, of course, the redoubtable Aleister Crowley, of whom more later in a subsequent talk. Samuel Liddell MacGregor Matthews was tall, clean-shaven, a clean-shaven face with an occasional military mustache, reddish blonde hair, and as I say, often wearing kilts and various other unusual attire, which, however, the English, who always liked their eccentrics, really enjoyed, I think, considerably. So we'll take a look at a very unusual individual who certainly has bequeathed some very important things to us, and that is Arthur Edward Waite, one of the more creative and truly mystically inclined members of the Golden Dawn, who eventually, albeit rather unsuccessfully, attempted to sort of found his own movement or turn one of the temples of the order into his own movement. Arthur Edward Waite, usually abbreviated as A.E. Waite. Waite was born, believe it or not, in the USA, and even more, believe it or not, in the rather unromantic and unmagical borough of Brooklyn. But he became an expatriate quite early in life, when his English mother took her infant son back to England. Waite's mother converted to Roman Catholicism and raised her son in that faith. As a young man in London, he encountered the then most fashionable occult movements, namely spiritualism and the Theosophical Society. He also discovered the writings of the French magical writer Eliphas Levy, and that made all the difference. Waite joined the Theosophical Society, where he met such folk as Annie Besant, A.P. Sinnett, Edward Maitland, the scribe and amanuensis of the Hermetic Society, and what might be called the Hermetic prophetess Anna Kingsford, and quite a few others. It was also in the Theosophical Society that he met the poet William Butler Yeats and the novelist Arthur Machen, who remained his lifelong friend. While in agreement with most of the Theosophical teachings, he was deeply suspicious of the teachings concerning Madame Blavatsky's teachers, usually referred to as the Masters or the Mahatmas. This disagreement caused Waite eventually to lose interest in the Theosophical Society, although he certainly absorbed many of its teachings. Waite's true interest was magic, in theory and in practice. In 1885, he published his first work, dealing with the substance of the teachings of Eliphas Levi. It was a sort of a recension of Levi's work. Now, you need to keep in mind that Levi's writings were mainly available in French, and that Waite was pretty much the first person to popularize Eliphas Levi in the English language. Following his interest, Waite joined the Golden Dawn, where under the tutelage of the formidable Samuel Liddell MacGregor Mathers, he passed through the grades of the First Order. He subsequently resigned, allegedly because he accused or at least suspected the chiefs of the Order of having fabricated their founding documents and thus their connection with Fräulein Sprengel in Germany. Now here I must sort of pause for a minute, because it's important to remember in this and many other contexts that Waite possessed an extremely critical, I would say a hypercritical mind, to which he gave expression in written and uttered statements characterized by unbelievable sarcasm and downright peevishness. He is one of the most infuriating writers whom it has ever been my dubious pleasure to study. You know, because in the majority of his books, about half of every page, if not more, is devoted to knocking some other writer or scholar, you know. And often really without much of a serious reason, except that he feels like doing it, you know. He felt like doing it. His writings, as indicated, are dilated with biting criticisms of other writers and occultists. And so I would say it stands to reason that his differences with the chiefs of the Golden Dawn were also of his own making. Otherwise, it was just a cantankerous cuss, to use a somewhat vernacular, the vernacular. Some years later, he rejoined the Golden Dawn, and then he tried to gain control over and reorganize the Isis Urania Temple in London by completely rewriting its rituals along the lines of what he felt was Christian mysticism. His attempt failed, for the members left in droves, proclaiming Waite's rituals to be ineffectual and boring. So there was that great attempt. Waite's most fervent interest now became the practice of Kabbalistic pathwork, a symbol system indicating the soul's ascent on the paths of the Tree of Life toward the Godhead. You're probably familiar with it. Since this practice, which was taught prominently by the Golden Dawn, involved the use of the tarot, Waite became responsible eventually for what still is the most popular and useful deck of the tarot, known usually, you guessed it, as the Waite deck, or the Rider pack, because of its original publisher, Rider and Company. Now here I need to explain a little bit. The idea that the cards of the tarot deck can be attributed systematically to various portions of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life was, as far as I am able to discern, first suggested by Eliphas Levi. But Eliphas Levi really started something, and What he started, I think, was very, very useful, because these attempts of meditatively and prayerfully and magically rising through the planes, or rising, or making one's consciousness rise along the paths of the tree of life, is tremendously facilitated by a specific, very creative kind of symbol being attributed to each one of these steps. And these symbols, of course, are the pictures on the cards of the tarot. So that the 22 cards of the major arcana are attributed to the 22 paths or channels on the tree of life, while in a certain order the numbered cards of the minor arcana are attributed to the Sephiroth themselves, which is a little less important for this exercise, and the court cards are attributed in various ways to the four worlds of the Olam. But the important issue here has to do with the major arcana. Now, the Golden Dawn chiefs who organized the practices and the symbols of the Golden Dawn were very intent on the value and the importance of this tarot symbolism. And they passed that on, of course, to A.E. Waite. Now, the way the Golden Dawn itself, the order dealt with the cards, was interesting but understandable in view of the circumstances of the time. After all, even in my time, and I am really not old enough to have been present at creation or at the creation of the Golden Dawn, in spite of what I look like. But let's say, in the 1950s, when I came to this country or so, it was darn difficult to get hold of any kind of a deck of tarot cards. Really difficult. You had to write to Timbuktu in New York or somewhere, and if you were lucky, they sent you usually a rather badly printed kind of cheap deck that would fall apart after a reasonable amount of use. And nothing else, there's just one kind of deck available. Certainly not the plethora that we have now, or even anything approximating it now. Since there were not many tarot cards available at that time, and probably what was available was the Marseille deck from France, the chiefs of the Golden Dawn said that each and every member had to make his own cards. Now, that would discourage quite a few people today, because I think the noble quality of sloth, otherwise known as laziness, is all prevalent in our midst. And so we don't want to do things like that. But anyway, they would give instructions as to what had to be on a card. And then each and every member, whether they were artistically inclined or not, had to draw their own cards. And they were the ones then that were used for the meditations of the pathwork and so forth. Waite eventually came to the conclusion that he could be instrumental in designing a deck of cards which would have strong Kabbalistic meaning, and which could be made available to the public rather than being secret like these handmade cards, and would be also quite beautiful at the same time, possessing maybe some aesthetic qualities that the French deck of Marseille did not possess. And so Waite became responsible for what is still therefore the most popular deck of cards, in collaboration with a then very young lady who was his student and a good artist, Pamela Coleman Smith. They designed an entire deck of tarot cards, which is somewhat sort of influenced by, some of the artistic styles of the time. One of the great advantages of that deck, which it has over most others, being that every card, including the minor arcana, has a separate and distinct picture. So that, let's say, in the Marseille deco, you just, if you have a 10 of wands or something, you would just have 10 sticks in the picture. But here there would be an entire little picture which represents symbolically, especially when one studies it sufficiently, really the meaning of that particular card. We can be said, so this is one thing that interrupting myself with my own permission, this is really one, what I think, very great and very wonderful thing that Waite bequeathed to us. Because that deck is still a very, very wonderful deck. It's very, very helpful. And it's great for divinatory purposes. It's great for meditative purposes. It's really a very fine deck. I would even venture to suggest, without waxing too complimentary here, that it's pretty much the best deck still that is around, that is on the market. Now, Waite, of course, Waite can be said to have occupied a kind of twilight zone between the Catholic Church and the esoteric or occult tradition, partly by way of his upbringing and also partly by way of his inclinations, let us say. He was an enthusiastic Freemason, which is not a terribly Catholic thing to do, I believe, contrary to Catholic law. He long held that, as he put it, that magic could provide the solution to the problems of the origin and destiny of man. Those are his words. Yet toward the end of the latter part of his life, he felt that within the Catholic Church was the work of the regeneration of man accomplished. His two chief contributions which have survived him are, number one, his tarot deck with his accompanying book, and his theory of a secret tradition underlying masonry, alchemy, and the Kabbalah, which he wrote about with some eloquence and depth in his book, The Hidden Church of the Holy Grail. So I would say, if you want to start with something reading Waite, well, read his tarot book and read The Hidden Church of the Holy Grail. It's a very creative and very interesting book. He wrote numerous large books on Kabbalah, Rosicrucianism, and ceremonial magic, all of which are tedious and not particularly useful at this time. The same may be said of his poetry, which is really worse than tedious. You know, there is hardly anything worse than a poet who thinks he's a good poet and he isn't or ain't. You know. However, let's say he enunciated in the Hidden Church of the Holy Grail an idea which, while not totally original, was still to a large extent, I think, you know, his discovery and has much merit. And that is the, a sort of a secret unifying tradition, which he felt was present in this case behind all of the traditions of Western spirituality, and which nourished them. In many of the details there are really, really interesting and inspiring. Of course, we need to keep in mind that there was already Blavatsky with a secret doctrine saying that there was a universal, not just Western, but a universal secret tradition, the Gupta Vidya, the secret tradition of, as it is called in Sanskrit, the secret doctrine, so to say, which runs through the entirety of the history of the human race. But Waite took, let's say, a portion of that and very greatly explored it regarding the Western tradition, and I think his ideas there have still a good deal of merit. The next person, whom we will consider a little more briefly, primarily because he's almost contemporary, And a good deal of information about him and about his work is generally available. And that is our fellow Angelino Paul Foster Case. He was certainly a person who managed to continue the Golden Dawn tradition in a more lasting and practical way. He was an American who was initially a member of one of the very few Golden Dawn extensions in the USA, a temple in Chicago. Case was a fine musician and earned his living in his early years as an organ player for the silent movies, which was not at all a bad profession at that time, but of course was shut down by the talkies when this was no longer needed. Case was a member of the Theosophical Society and for a time presided over a Kabbalistic lodge of the Theosophical Society in Pasadena. He was an ordained priest of the Theosophically inspired Liberal Catholic Church and frequently celebrated Mass at which at that time was St. Albans Liberal Catholic Pro-Cathedral on Argyle Avenue, which is now a very beautiful Russian Orthodox Church in Hollywood, as well as another Liberal Catholic House of Worship in Pasadena. And I know on fairly good authority that from an ecclesiastical point of view, he was an excellent ritualist, an excellent celebrant, one of the reasons for it being that during many of his masses, the church organ was played by my late and ex-wife, who was the church organist at St. Albans on Argyle Avenue. He knew Paul Foster Case quite well. He had great respect for him as a priest, as well as in other ways. That was a very interesting man. With time, Case and his followers organized an occult body called the Builders of the Aditum, abbreviated BOTA, and pronounced by a lot of people for some curious reason, BOTA, which I don't know, sort of sounds to me like a science fiction name, you know. In any event, and this organization marketed courses in Tarot and Kabbalah by mail order, most of which were written by Paul Foster Case, or all of them at one time, and experienced considerable success for many years. The courses instructed many thousands in these subjects. Paul Foster Case also authored several fine books, one of which, The Tarot, The Key to the Mystery of the Ages, is perhaps the finest work ever published on the major arcana, in my view. At their fine headquarters on Figueroa Street, on the northern edge of Los Angeles, the local members of the BOTA held regular temple meetings based on the rituals of the Golden Dawn. They also had their own tarot deck, but Case, perhaps taking into account that well-known quality of the human race that I mentioned before, namely sloth, didn't make people draw their own cards, but they were pre-printed in a black and white fashion, and then the members had to color the cards. A little concession to that well-known laziness, you know. Very nice deck of cards at that. Paul Foster Case died, I believe, in the 1940s, but it seemed a whole number of important people whom I would have had liked to have at least gotten a glimpse of, they all died just before I got here. Whether there is some great message in this or not, I don't know, but I thought I'd share it with you anyway, you know. So it was in his case, and his successor and star pupil, Ann Davies, continued his work with much charm and charisma. I remember her well, and I thought that she was really a terrific lady. and I had a few glasses of a very fine whiskey with her, which she kept in her office, which I always regard as one of the true hallmarks of a fine esotericist. Why? Well, because, you know, spirit is spirit. People who are interested in spirit and who will offer a guest a good spirit, they are spiritual people. That's it. Mm-hmm. In any event, quite aside from that, she was a very humorous, a very charming, a very energetic lady who led that organization with great elan. After her death, which I think occurred in the late 1970s or early 80s, the organization went through dissensions and vicissitudes, and can be said, I think, to have declined, although still active. So here are two people, one in England, one in America, who continued in their own way, at least tried, the Golden Dawn tradition, and each one with some success. Now, just a few more words, because we have to conclude, about someone who really requires a great deal more, the man who during his lifetime was known as the greatest poet of the English language, William Butler Yeats, who as a young man had joined the Golden Dawn, and who even after the Golden Dawn went out of business, so to say, outwardly, still maintained his magical training, and there is definite evidence indicating that Yeats had his own private magical temple, and he would occasionally perform the Golden Dawn magical practices. He was an adept of the Golden Dawn up to the end of his days. And when people asked him why he did that, he said that because his artistic creativity depended on his magic. He said the magic was the source of his inspiration. The magic was the source of his poetry. Of course, he was interested in many things, in the Celtic revival. He was an Anglo-Irishman. And however, he held and he occasionally talked about the fact that to him, the ceremonial magic and the magical practices were the greatest stimulus to artistic creativity that he knew. He also did other things. For instance, it is well known that later on, right around the time of World War I, between 1917 and 1919, Yeats and his wife, who, as you might imagine, was also involved in all kinds of magical activities, with their combined visions, wrote a strange book that you can still find sometime, which is called A Vision. Sort of thing that people did at that time. Dion Fortune wrote one of that sort too, which was called The Cosmic Doctrine. These were visionary treatises, of course, with Yeats, you can imagine, of a very poetic nature, that described the spirit worlds and some predictions about the future and many other things. So let's say his talents and his activities were manifold. You will not find too much reference to his magical activities in books of literature that write about Yeats, and they try to underplay this, but he was also a very prominent member of the Theosophical Society, and again a close, much younger friend of Madame Blavatsky, who loved him dearly and who used to speak about him as our Willy. You know, our Willy. Great and wonderful gentleman, William Butler Yeats. And of course, the visionary quality permeates a lot of his work. And I'll, more or less in conclusion, because our time is up, we'll read a little visionary poem of his, which is very well known. It was written in 1921, called The Second Coming. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed and everywhere. the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming, hardly are these words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. I would think it's as likely to be apposite for this time as it may have been for previous times. I somehow recognize our own time in it, but you know, every time is probably like that, because every time is the worst of times and the best of times, as an other writer had pointed out. Anyway, these were some of the great outstanding members of the early Golden Dawn. Of course, Yeats was younger than the rest, and he lived for a much longer period of time. And this probably gives you a little idea of this truly, truly magnificent, creative, poetic, romantic development that started at that time, and the results of which are still with us, and the seeds that fell from that magnificent flower perhaps are growing again and will flower again with great power and with great beauty. And I invite you to the next installment of our discussion a week from tonight, and until then, I thank you very much.
Copyright MNBII by BC Recordings, catalog number 304103. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.